24-hour weather center. I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the October issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start with an article titled The State Fair of Texas, A Collection of Weird and True Facts by Mike Lowry. There's no substitute for the 24-day extravaganza of the Texas spirit. The cancellation of the fair this year wasn't exactly surprising, but that doesn't make it any less disappointing. Where else can you find Fair Park sensory overload? Its jovial jumble of attractions, from dancing troops to dancing fountains, live music to livestock, and big hair to big techs. In 134 years, the State Fair has only been canceled 9 times. The last time was during World War II. While we can't gather in Dallas this year for our annual traditions, we know the State Fair of Texas is also a state of mind. So, here we present an homage to the State Fair of Texas. Big Tex. He's 55 feet tall, has a 95-gallon hat, and he is the Texas Size Fair mascot. He was originally a Santa Claus and was converted into a cowboy in 1952. He was purchased for just $750. In 2013, the new Big Tex cost $500,000. He wears Luchase boots. In the 1970s, a replacement shirt for Big Tex was stolen out of the delivery truck. His pants and shirt are made by Dickies, and his boots are a size 96. Since 2005, the best new dishes at the fair have competed in the annual Big Tex Choice Awards, and here are a few notable entries. Ruth's Stuffed Mexicone includes salsa, black beans, rice, queso, lime, all in a cone-shaped tortilla. Big Red Chicken Bread, fried chicken, little glasses, and a big red flavored donut. Deep-fried chicken noodle soup, broth, crackers, and voila, you have deep-fried chicken noodle soup on a stick. Pinanor popcorn, covered in wine powder and mixed with cheese popcorn. Classy. The Cotton Candy Taco includes cotton candy in a graham cracker taco shell. And finally, Smoky Bacon Margarita, a margarita with bacon bits. There are many things we'll miss about the fair this year, but the indulgent and bizarre fried foods might top that list. How many of these deep-fried delicacies have you tried in the past or plan to try next year? Let's play Deep Fried Bingo. So on the bingo card, there is deep fried butter, deep fried spaghetti and meatballs, deep fried pizza, deep fried jelly beans, deep fried Coke, deep fried Kool-Aid, deep fried Fruit Loops, deep fried peanut butter and a banana burger, and finally, deep fried s'mores. So I'm sure this is making your mouth drool. The fair has only been canceled a few times, like during World War I and World War II. During the First World War, the fairgrounds were used as an army encampment. And there were a few notable guests then. Booker T. Washington, 1900. Harry Houdini in 1924. Elvis in 1956. Debbie Reynolds in 1977, Selena in 1994, and lots of presidents, including Taft. And don't forget, next time you go, on Wednesdays, admission is just $4 if you bring 2 cans of food. And the State Fair coupons, the fair's currency, never expire. And then there's the Red River Showdown, a.k.a. the Red River Shootout, a state fair tradition for over 100 years. The Longhorns and the Sooners have been rivals since 1900. That's longer than Oklahoma has been a state. Dallas is almost exactly equidistant from both schools. OU is actually slightly closer. The Golden Hat was originally made out of bronze. UT leads the series overall, but OU has won 7 of the past 10 games. And Texas won 8 years in a row, twice. Fletcher's Corny Dogs debuted in 1942. That's 10 years before Big Tex. Originally, they were just 15 cents each. They were created by vaudeville performers Neil and Carl Fletcher. Over 500,000 corny dogs are sold each year over the 24-day event. That's 60,000 pounds of hot dogs. They go through 1,500 gallons of mustard and 800 gallons of ketchup every year. Fletcher says mustard is the correct way to top a corny dog, but started making ketchup available in 1994 due to customer demand. Fair Park is home to one of the world's largest collections of Art Deco architecture. A popular attraction in 1938 was Bozo, the mind-reading dog. The State Fair of Texas by the numbers. The fair started in 1886, and it's still held in the same spot. It has grown from 80 acres to a whopping 277 acres. That's almost twice the size of Disneyland. Admission to the state fair was originally 50 cents. In 1897, a featured exhibit was a preserved 80,000-pound whale. One year, it rained for 17 days of the month-long fair. 14,000 people attended opening day in 1886. And in 2019, more than 2.5 million people attended. The world record for largest butter sculpture was set by the fair in 2013 by Sharon Booman for her massive Big Tex made out of over 4,000 pounds of butter. And now let's stay in the Dallas-Fort Worth area with this article, Flipping the Script, What Do We Really Know About Bonnie and Clyde and Their Legacy in Dallas? By Sarah Heppola. Every fall since 2010, the good people of Pilot Point gather in their town square to watch a robbery. As teens slump on bleachers and tap their smartphones, adults slide their cameras into shooting position for the big event. It's time for the reenactment of a getaway scene from the 1967 movie Bonnie and Clyde, filmed right here. Scene might be a stretch for what's about to happen. Actors in period costumes dart out the front door of a farmer's and merchant's bank and hustle into a V8 Ford that squeals around the corner as cops give chase. It's 30 seconds of action at most. More than 200 people flank the street across from the bank for the culmination of the 2019 Bonnie and Clyde Days Festival. On this blue sky October day, they are blissfully unaware that such a feel-good community gathering will itself turn outlaw less than 6 months later, with the pandemic squashing this year's event. I'm a city girl who grew up in Dallas with her eyes on bigger, better towns, but I spent that afternoon charmed by the easy camaraderie of Pilot Point, population 3,865. I marveled at the soapbox derby and pie-eating contest, details of small-town life I'd only seen in movies. The myth-making power of the silver screen was, and is, at the heart of the festival. The posters made clear this was not a celebration of two real-life bandits who left a trail of 13 dead, but rather, the day Hollywood came to town. Pilot Point is known for high school football and cabinet-making. It's like the capital of cabinets in North Texas, the mayor told me. That a movie as fabled as Bonnie and Clyde was partly filmed here, that stars as iconic as Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway walked these avenues, well, it was an event so singular that children got the day off from school to gather in the town square and watch the filming, much like we were doing a half century later. Never mind that the movie was so grim and blood-spattered, it ushered in a new era of cinematic violence. All that took a back seat to the glittering notion that, once upon a time, Hollywood chose Pilot Point. I drove back home to Dallas, an hour south on Interstate 35, where Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow were raised. They fell in love in my city. They slept and dreamed in my city. They fought and cursed and longed for bigger, better lives in my city. But the best way to characterize the relationship between Dallas and its notorious criminal duo would be to say there isn't one. No museum, no murals, and certainly no festivals to commemorate the fact that two dirt-poor kids from the West Side grew up to become a Romeo and Juliet for the Public Enemy age. The only official designation is a historical marker near Clyde's grave in an Oak Cliff cemetery. But it's the gravestone's epitaph, written by Clyde, that tells the truer story. Etched in black granite are the words, "Gone, but not forgotten." If anything, Bonnie and Clyde were smaller than life. She was 4'11" and less than 100 pounds. He was just shy of 5'6" and weighed 125. Clyde's family came to Dallas after the collapse of the farm they were tenants on in Tellico, about 40 miles south, when he was 12. The Barrows were part of a rural migration that transformed cities in the years after the Great War and before the Great Depression. They were so poor, for a period they slept under their wagon on the floodplain of the Trinity River, in a part of town so lawless it was known as the Devil's Back Porch. Dallas was a banking and financial center. Its founders designed the city to attract elites and keep out unsavory types. But if you stand on the edge of the Trinity, as Clyde doubtlessly did as a young man, what you see are high-rises and skyscrapers, all the wealth and glory that exist on the other side. Clyde wanted to be a musician. He played guitar and saxophone, but his nimble fingers proved more profitable hot wiring cars. He'd already been arrested and sent to jail a few times before the day in January 1930 that he walked into a party and met the woman who would die at his side. He was 20, she was 19. Bonnie Parker was one of the smartest kids in her class at a time when smarts didn't get a girl far. Her father died when she was 4, and she became a flirtatious, attention-seeking young woman. She was a waitress at a cafe on Swiss Circle, near the present-day Baylor University Medical Center, but she longed to be famous. She took pictures of herself in Hollywood starlet poses, like the ghost of Instagram future. Whether her role in this saga is better understood as a lovesick codependent or a tough broad blowing up assumptions about the fairer sex, what's clear is Bonnie made Clyde a legend. Without her, he's just another two-bit crook in an era teeming with them. But with her riding shotgun, they make history. Bonnie and Clyde were the Kardashians on media steroids, says Jeff Gwynn, the Fort Worth writer whose gripping account of the couple, Go Down Together, rubs the gloss from the saga to find the troubled humans underneath. They became media sensations, whose two-year crime spree through Texas and the Midwest was breathlessly tracked by a news industry eager for eyeballs, and a public eager for escapism. Sound familiar? Pictures of the outlaws had been discovered by the cops and published in the papers. The shocking, deeply unladylike photos of Bonnie in a beret, variously poking the barrel of a shotgun into Clyde's stomach and chomping on a cigar, scandalized the masses. A woman. In reality, Bonnie never smoked cigars, and she only shot a gun twice, once by accident and once during a botched holdup when she deliberately fired to miss because she didn't want to hurt anyone. It's possible she killed a pig on the road, Gwynn tells me, but the self-mythologizing images helped turn the couple into folk heroes. This was at a time when plenty of desperate people would have enjoyed sticking it to the man. As the body count escalated, however, public sympathy dwindled. 13 people had died, mostly trying to stop them, by the morning of May 23, 1934, when officers set an ambush off the side of a highway in Gibbsland, Louisiana. Led by Texas Ranger Frank Kamer, the posse, dramatized in the 2019 Netflix movie The Highwaymen, fired some 150 rounds into the shiny V8 Ford. Clyde was 24 when he died. Bonnie was 23. But their story was just beginning. How this tale's shape shifts over the next century reveals a narrative about a changing world. Depression-era audiences knew the couple as Clyde and Bonnie, for instance. That's because he was the man in charge, and she was the little lady. Clyde and Bonnie just sounds like a Midwest Christian couple who owns a Chick-fil-A, quipped one of the hosts of Last Podcast on the Left, a participant in the expansive true crime podcast genre. For a modern audience drawn to tales of complicated women, Bonnie would have to take top billing. The pulp novels of the 40s and 50s recast Bonnie as the leader of the gang, taking their cue from the femme fatales in the hard-boiled fiction of Dashiell Hammett. True crime magazines portrayed Bonnie as a killer in skirts, or 90 pounds straight out of hell. The Bonnie Parker story hit screens in 1958, with a poster featuring a blonde woman dangling a cigar from her lips as she fires a Tommy gun. The mostly forgotten movie was beloved by Quentin Tarantino, who also riffed on the Bonnie and Clyde myth with his screenplays, True Romance, and Natural Born Killers. But it's the stylish 1967 Arthur Penn movie, the Pilot Point one, that brands the couple into the late 20th century imagination. Filmed all around North Texas and co-written by Waxahachie native Robert Benton, the movie's gleeful nihilism struck a chord with a counterculture audience, and the names Bonnie and Clyde became synonymous with dark glamour. In the 90s, rapper Tupac Shakur name-checked the duo in Me and My Girlfriend, a love song to his gun released after he was shot dead in a car in 1996. A year later, Eminem rapped about killing his ex-wife and dumping her body in a lake in the song 97 Bonnie and Clyde, originally released as Just the Two of Us. Jay-Z and Beyoncé put a sunnier spin on things with 03 Bonnie and Clyde, a bling-era anthem that drops references to Birkin bags and Burberry. This image of a ride-or-die couple uniting not to rob banks but to take on the world is so winning that it's not unusual to see a man on a dating site saying he's looking for his Bonnie. Earlier this year, as if to prove the Bonnie and Clyde mythology has been so thoroughly metabolized, it hardly means anything, the names were slapped on memes of a middle-aged white couple who pulled guns on Black Lives Matter protesters in an affluent gated community in St. Louis. What's remarkable about how large Bonnie and Clyde loom in the public consciousness is how whisper quiet their presence is in Dallas, the city that shaped them. My house is about 2 miles from the cafe where Bonnie poured coffee, a vacant crescent-shaped building that I must have passed 100 times without knowing of its history. The service station where the Barrow family once lived stands on the corner of Singleton Boulevard and Borger Street. The derelict brown building, with boarded windows and white graffiti, is just over a mile away from the $182 million Margaret Hunt Hill Bridge and the Trinity Grove Strip of restaurants, which have helped transform the forgotten part of town, once known as the Devil's Back Porch, into a spot for top-shelf margaritas and killer guacamole. The city hides from its past like we owe it money, writes Robert Walensky in a Dallas Morning News story about the battle over the fate of the Barrow gas station, as well as an abandoned building around the corner known as the McBride House, where Clyde killed an officer in a 1933 ambush. Both have become points of contention in a rapidly developing neighborhood. Whether these ramshackle structures are blights in need of destruction or artifacts in need of preservation depends on whom you ask. History, like all stories, is a very complicated bargain. As I drive around small-town Texas, I'm struck by the number of spots that tout an association with Bonnie and Clyde. In Mineola, the popular East Texas Burger Company's menu claims the couple had a shootout in the alley, and it wasn't over a burger. In Carthage, the Charming Texas Tea Room hangs the reward sign for the outlaws, a reminder that they once roamed the territory. But in Dallas, long tainted as the site of John F. Kennedy's assassination, the duo's past, dark past, is harder to claim. The only business I found with an authentic connection to the couple was a random sports bar in a Hilton in Grapevine. Bonnie and Clyde's hideout is named for its proximity to a secret spot where the couple used to meet family members while they were eluding the law. I admired our archival photos and old news clippings on the walls as men drank alone at tables watching the game. I was hit with a wave of tenderness for whoever had curated this collection. This was not some soulless hotel sports bar, as I had mistakenly imagined, but a place that connected me to the real people who had passed through, who had fought themselves and their own histories, who struggled to get away and then to get back. But it's hard to strike the right balance between knowing history and glorifying it. Not too far from that bar, off State Highway 114 and neighboring South Lake, you can find a modest memorial to the officers who lost their lives after a run-in with the duo in 1934. Those men were real, too. I was disappointed when Pilot Point canceled Bonnie and Clyde Days this year. I had the best time last October, clapping like a little girl at a peanut thresher demonstration and taking photos of tractors. I spent the first half of my life trying to get out of Texas, and I'll probably spend the second half trying to get back in. It's a quirky little festival, Mayor Shay Dane Pat Patterson says of the event she helped create. She was disappointed, too, but what can you do? The festival is a break-even affair, but the joy was in the gathering. What the real Bonnie and Clyde had in common with the people of Pilot Point, and with me, and with most of us, is that they wanted to be connected to something greater than themselves. Their story is a cautionary tale about a lust for fame and the tragic allure of crime, but it's also about small people who wanted to be bigger. Patterson told me some folks don't like the idea of celebrating criminals, but that's why she reminds everyone this is about the movie. The actual Bonnie and Clyde never robbed the Farmers and Merchants Bank in Pilot Point anyway, though there's a rumor they were once seen in the town square. It's believed the reason they never robbed it was they had family in the area, Patterson says, but like so much of their story, no one knows for sure. And now just a reminder, you're listening to Travelin' Texas on Sight Into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight Into Sound on Channel HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, Channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. And now continuing on with articles from the October issue of Texas Highways, we'll go with the day tripper as he presents his top five things to do in Taylor, where barbecue reigns supreme. A trip to Taylor provides the essentials of any Lone Star diet, slow-smoked barbecue and cold local beer. Along with the incredible food, the Central Texas town features fascinating people and history. Put on your stretchy pants and get ready for a gut-busting good time. Louis Miller Barbecue. Known as the Cathedral of Smoke, this spot is one of Texas's most beloved barbecue joints. Since Louis Miller first started serving barbecue in 1949, it's been a no-frills kind of place. The rub is just salt and pepper, but you'll feel like you're tasting magic as you bite down on brisket, sausage, and the restaurant's world-famous beef ribs. The walls are filled with photos and old business cards, making it appear frozen in time. Grab a tray and experience a true Texas icon. Taylor Cafe. For more amazing beef, head down the street to the small cafe that charismatic late owner Vincel Meres made famous. The separate bars and jukeboxes tell the story of segregation in Taylor, but also how the community found common ground in great local barbecue. Meres passed away in 2019, but his legacy lives on in every platter. Belly up to the bar and enjoy a plate of tasty barbecue, and don't miss the homemade turkey sausage. Moody Museum. Give your stomach a rest and fill your brain at this local museum featuring some big personalities hailing from Taylor. Housed in Dan Moody's former home, it tells the story of how its namesake attorney defeated the Ku Klux Klan in court and became the youngest governor in Texas history at age 33. There are also exhibits on locals Bill Pickett, the famous black rodeo champ, and Tex Avery, the cartoonist who created Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and many of the beloved Looney Tunes characters. Texas Beer Company. Taylor's historic downtown is experiencing a renaissance fueled by passionate entrepreneurs and brewers. Join the community at this craft brewery, and you'll find yourself sharing a pint with everyone from attorneys to hay farmers. Try the local, the Blonde Lager, or the Bill Pickett Porter, and toast to Texas. And finally, the Davis Grocery and Barbecue. Check out this under-the-radar grocery store and barbecue stop if you're still in the mood for a snack. The store has two pits in the back run by the Reverend James Davis, a local Baptist minister. Many folks might argue that his true ministry is serving up slow-cooked meats. Along with the typical cuts, Davis makes amazing mutton and pork steak smothered with his signature comeback sauce. It's barbecue that's not just good for the taste buds, but also for the soul. So, whether you follow my footsteps or forge your own path, I hope to see you on the road. And with that, we have come to the end of our program. I've been reading Travelin' Texas. I'm Lynette McLamory, and this has been a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Gardener, followed by the Western Magazine Hour at 5.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
When it's open, Mifflin County Public Library, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Curbside pickup at Downtown Branch, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday.
If you're a do-it-yourselfer, don't let physical challenges limit your imagination. Each week, the guys on The Blind Handyman answer questions and offer tips on home maintenance and upgrades. The Blind Handyman, direct from Lufkin, Texas, Monday nights at 7, Saturdays at noon, and Sunday nights at 11 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area.
It's 72 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s.
From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Janet Roberts and I will be reading The Texas Gardener here on Sight into Sound Radio. From The Texas Gardener, White in the Garden by Dr. William C. Welch continued. Few plants are tougher than the Henry Dulberg salvia that thrives in Texas heat and blooms spikes of blue flowers from late spring through fall. A sometimes overlooked beauty is the white flowering form of Augusta Dulberg. While heat and drought tolerant, they perform best when cut back mid to late summer, which stimulates a beautiful fall display. Small flowering trees can be another opportunity to bring white into the garden. Crepe myrtles come in dwarf and full-size white forms. Flowering dogwood is one of our most beautiful native trees, but only thrives in acidic, well-drained soil. The layer effect of the branching and floral display adds a beautiful touch to any garden. White forms of redbud and Mexican plums add short seasons of color, as well as decorating trunks and stems to our gardens. Natchez crepe myrtles have beautiful peeling bark revealing cinnamon-colored trunks. Severely pruning crepe myrtles results in destroying their natural form, so it is best to only remove crossing limbs and spent flowers. Beware of overpruning, which may result in crepe murder. I hope this survey serves as an inspiration for incorporating white into your own garden while making it a more beautiful and meaningful space for you and your family. From the Texas Gardener, Springtime Means Azalea Time by Keith Hansen. I live in the northeastern part of Texas where pine trees grow like weeds thanks to the acidic soil and high annual rainfall. This combination makes it possible to easily grow a wide range of different kinds of plants that thrive in these conditions, especially azaleas. Starting this month, azaleas become shining beacons of color at home and commercial landscapes all across East Texas. Tyler, where I live, is home to the Tyler Azalea Trails, which draw tens of thousands of visitors every year to tour the miles of brick and paved streets where azaleas grow and bloom in abundance. This year will be the 60th annual event, and it is always worth a trip. However, Tyler is not the only place to see azaleas in abundance. The River Oaks Garden Club in Houston has been featuring an azalea trail for 85 years, which includes tours of the Bayou Bend home and garden, along with other homes and gardens in the area. A relative newcomer to the azalea trail world is located in Nacogdoches, the oldest town in Texas. 2000 marks the first year the Nacogdoches Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Flora Garden Club established the Nacogdoches Azalea Trail with 25 miles of trails through the historical town. But what sets this display apart is the amazing and enormous azalea collection featured in the SFA Gardens on the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University. What began as a vision by Dr. Dave Creech and a graduate thesis project in 1997 has resulted in a first-class garden. What was once a privet-infested bottomland loblolly forest periodically inundated with floodwater from Lanana Creek is now the largest azalea garden in Texas, with more than 7,000 azalea bushes, along with Japanese maple, dogwood, and camellia companions nearby. Barbara Stump was the graduate student tasked with designing an 8-acre azalea garden for her MA thesis when Dottie Wisely stepped in and provided an endowment to actually create the designed garden. The result is the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden, which was dedicated in 2000 and completed in 2002. There are 46 beds filled with azaleas, camellias, Japanese maples, and many other special plants, accessed by more than a mile of easily traveled paved walkways. Many benches are available for sitting when one may pause to reflect and enjoy the overpowering beauty of so many azaleas of every kind and color. There are more than 550 different kinds of azaleas, 100 varieties of camellias blooming from fall through early spring, and special collections of hydrangeas, boxwoods, Japanese plum yew, and other rare and interesting plants. Also interspersed throughout are hundreds of Japanese maple varieties that compete with the azaleas with their beautiful new spring foliage. Then, in late fall, about the end of November, the Ruby M. Mize Garden is transformed and another blaze of color as the Japanese maple put on their end-of-year fall display with yellow, oranges, reds, and purples. Don't think you can tour this garden in half an hour when it is in full bloom during March and April. The winding trails take you through vista upon vista of masses of azaleas in an array of colors and delightful color combinations, making every bend in the trails a Kodak moment. You'll feel like you've left the busy world behind and are immersed in the beauty of nature, surrounded by a spectrum of soft and hot pinks, oranges, yellows, purples, reds, whites, and color blends blooming under the towering canopy of pines and southern sugar maples. The large sweeping beds are organized by azalea hybrid groups, where masses of representative cultivars of each type show you their potential impact if similarly used in your own landscape. You'll find a collection of the rare hang azalea varieties, which were bred in China and brought to the U.S. a mere 40 years ago. There are the groups of early blooming azaleas like the Karoom and Southern Indica hybrids. These will be followed a few weeks later by the mid-season spring bloomers like Robin Hill, Girard, Carla, and Glendale hybrids. Later in May, you'll find the striking Satsuki hybrids. Satsuki means fifth month in Japanese, with a spectrum of hues, sometimes with unusual random patterns of mixed colors in a single bloom. And then there are the taller, growing deciduous azaleas native of North America, sporting fragrant honeysuckle-shaped blooms before the leaves cover the upright branches. Depending on the species or hybrid, their flower color ranges from pale to medium pink, yellow, a color not represented by the Asian evergreen azaleas, tangerine orange, and brilliant red. These are also represented by their hybrid groups, such as the Aromi and Confederate series. Guided tours are available for groups through the garden during the Azalea Trail, and the Ruby M. Mize Garden hosts other events, including a Little Princess Tea Party and an annual Azalea Symposium. In 2011, azaleas in the SFA Gardens expanded with the creation of the Gala Mize Garden right across from University Drive from the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden. SFA graduate Ray Mize urged David Creech, SFA garden director, to turn this area into a beautiful garden. Originally called the SFA Recreational Trails and Gardens, it was renamed in honor of Gala Mize, a long-term supporter of Nacogdoches Beautiful and the SFA Gardens. This 8-acre garden continues the tradition of bringing unique, new, or underused, unknown plants to trial and display. Since the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden mainly, but not solely, features evergreen azaleas native to Asia, the emphasis in the Gala Mize Garden will be on the distinctive and beautiful azaleas and their hybrids native to the U.S. These azaleas are deciduous, losing their leaves in the winter and bursting forth with brilliant and fragrant honeysuckle-shaped flowers in the springtime, often before the leaves emerge. Their growth habit, unlike the mounding evergreen azaleas, are upright, letting them shine above lower growing plants. And the flower colors range from pink to flaming red to brilliant golden yellow and blends of all the foregoing colors. In addition to azaleas, the Gala Mize Garden also displays other collections, including crinums, camellias, and a variety of other unique, rare, and special plants. While visiting, don't miss the labyrinth surrounded by a ring of slender silhouette sweet gum trees. Driving down University Drive in the spring, you do not want to miss these two gardens when their signature azalea, Koromo Shibuku, is blooming. They line both sides of University Drive for more than 800 feet. This unique azalea has spider-like light purple petals and was selected because it is close to FSA's school color. If you are planning a visit to Nacogdoches to see these two azalea gardens, check with the Nacogdoches Visitor Bureau. See, timing for the prime bloom period varies from year to year depending on the weather, but in general, mid-March through early April, you should be able to enjoy the beauty of these gardens. If you come later, you may see many of the Satsuki varieties, which bloom in late April and into early June, depending on the variety. and the popular Encore series and other reblooming azaleas that produce a second wave of colorful blooms later in the year. The Disappeared Man Who Loved Azaleas by William Shike. The luxurious blooms of Hoang azalea hybrids hide a sad story about their corrector, T. Lin Hoang. This historically obscure man lived in China, where he bred numerous varieties of his beloved plant. During his homeland's Cultural Revolution between 1966 and 1976, Hoang was abruptly uprooted from his private azalea-strewn Shangri-La. Along with countless others, Hoang was forced to labor on collective farms, where his life was plowed under by history. Ruined, too, were his extensive azalea collections and the meticulous records he kept about their breeding. Even so, Hoang's spirit lived on in some of his hybrids surviving at the Shanghai Botanical Garden. Rooted cuttings from these azaleas found their way to the U.S. during the 1980s. Since the varieties lacked names, Peter Vines assigned each one a numerical code for bloom time, size, and hue. Vine's favorite was HU2122, code for late April large single light pink flowers. Vines personally dubbed it Tiananmen Square. Currently, some Hoang azalea fans campaign for adopting this as its official English cultivar designation, as well as for likewise attributing apt names to other Hoang varieties. From the Texas Gardener, Great Texas Farmers Markets by Jay White. Farmers markets have come a long way in my lifetime. The markets my family visited in the 1960s and 70s were simple affairs. The market we visited most often consisted of a corrugated metal roof supported by a rusty pipe structure. Growers backed their trucks under the roof and sold their produce from their tailgates. Today, farmers markets have become much more than a place to buy fresh seasonal produce. While some of the markets in rural areas remain fairly simple affairs, larger urban markets have become sprawling venues that offer live entertainment, activities for children, and unique experiences for adults. Think goat yoga. In addition to people selling produce, it is not uncommon to find cut flower growers next to vendors offering artisanal breads, cheeses, canned goods, grass-fed beef, and even jewelry. Farmers markets have become anchors of their communities that attract a diverse group of customers who value fresh food and the people who grow it for them. Texas is blessed with a myriad of markets. The markets mentioned in this article represent what you can find at your own local market. While not all of them offer goat yoga, they all offer local producers who strive to provide you with the freshest and highest quality items available. Dallas Farmers Market. Visit the Dallas Farmers Market any weekend throughout the year to experience the best of Texas, homegrown, handcrafted, and one of a kind. Seasonal flavors abound in the shed with local farmers, ranchers, and artisans who bring their best to customers with pride. For a special treat, catch one of the many festivals and cultural celebrations, such as Dallas's Original Watermelon Festival in August or Dallas's Original Pumpkin Festival in October. There is always something new to enjoy between the teaching garden with little farmer activities, seasonal recipe testings from chef demos, and even goat yoga. You're listening to the Texas Gardener on Sight Into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight Into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, Channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our archives page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. San Antonio, Pearl Weekend Market. Pearl Weekend Market is a true representation of South Texas' growing, ranching, and artisanal food community. Pearl Weekend Market is the largest producer-only operation in San Antonio. Since 2009, the market has grown to include 50-plus vendors representing the best in produce, meat, dairy, eggs, baked goods, locally produced cheeses, olive oils, and a diverse selection of preferred foods and treats from a 150-mile radius. Waco. Waco Downtown Farmers Market. The Waco Downtown Farmers Market, WDFM, has hosted a year-round Saturday market experience for Waco residents and visitors since 2011. Working with the City of Waco, the WDFM was permitted to develop an agricultural market with focus on agriculture producers and growers rather than on artisan vendors. Even the prepared food and value-added vendors are required to use local agricultural products that they sell at market, including kombucha infused with locally grown lavender and pupusas featuring curtido with locally grown cucumbers. To expand the sale of producers, the WDFM launched an online store in 2019 so that customers unable to attend the Saturday market could purchase products for a Tuesday afternoon pickup. The market also accepts SNAP/EBT and can match all SNAP purchases up to $20 a day through a program called Double Up Food Bucks to be used solely on fresh fruits and vegetables. Families utilizing WIC benefits can also receive $30 in vouchers per eligible family member, also to be used on fresh fruits and vegetables. The staff of the Waco Downtown Farmers Market is continually looking for creative new ways to encourage more people in our community to support, buy, and be local. Denton, the Denton Community Market. The Denton Community Market is a producer-only venue for farmers and artisans offering goods produced within a 100-mile radius of Denton, Texas. It provides live music from the local Denton music scene as well as family-friendly activities and special events such as Harvest Day, Hispanic Heritage Festival, Farm Heritage Festival, Spooky Market, and the Holiday Market. All farmers are DCM certified as using sustainable farming practices and as local producers. The market is open 9 to 1 for regular hours, April to November, and summer hours, 8 a.m. to noon, for summer hours during June to August. Dripping Springs, Dripping Springs Farmers Market. Experience the taste of the hill country at the Dripping Springs Farmers Market. The backbone of the market are the farmers and ranchers who bring their locally grown fruits and vegetables, meats, pasteurized eggs, honey, and wine to town. Other vendors bring baked and prepared foods, ready-to-eat meals, handmade body care products, and crafts for shoppers eager to purchase them. Now in its 10th year, the market is the largest midweek farmer market in Central Texas and was recently voted the number one farmer's market in Texas and the Southwest by the American Farmland Trust for the second year in a row. The grassy park with picnic tables beneath large shade trees and live entertainment creates the perfect setting for the best gathering in Dripping Springs. The market is open Wednesday from 3 to 6 p.m. year-round with an ongoing calendar of special events. For more information, visit the Dripping Springs Farmers Market Facebook page. Galveston, Galveston's own Farmers Market. Galveston's own Farmers Market, GOFM, brings locally grown produce, prepared foods, and edible farm products to residents of Galveston and the surrounding areas. The year-round market provides an affordable venue for vendors to sell fresh-grown and prepared foods. It enhances the quality of life of Galveston residents by improving accessibility to the local food economy and providing a forum for community activities. In addition to the twice-weekly market, GOFM established the Young Gardener Program, partnering with the school district to integrate a high-production garden and advanced curriculum with the after-school program, teaching young people to put their hands in the dirt, eat well, and learn the transformative power of growing their own food. Another GOFM program, the Real Food Project, offers monthly cooking classes and community dinners as a way to help educate Galveston households how to prepare tasty meals with fresh produce. For more information about how to sign up to be a vendor, volunteer, or to donate or sponsor the market, visit www.galvestonsownfarmersmarket.com. Austin, Barton Creek Farmers Market. Barton Creek Farmers Market is Austin's first farmers market, beginning on the Whole Foods parking lot in 1987. It supports small farmers first and foremost with an emphasis on organically grown. The market encourages all of their food vendors to source local farmers for their ingredients, offering only natural ingredients. The market is working on a project to create land trust in order to create a future for small farms. It also promotes local artisans, prepared food vendors, and other small businesses in order for them to test their products. The market presents live music by local musicians who perform original music every Saturday, and it offers a children's music hour almost every Saturday, plus a petting zoo once a month. The market's vision is to create a healthy, sustainable future for all. Sustainable Food Center. Sustainable Food Center runs two weekly farmers markets that support more than 100 small businesses in the Austin area. These two markets are producer-only. Farmers and ranchers grow and raise their own vegetables and livestock, and value-added providers, food providers, and artisans make everything themselves. SFC offers access to this locally grown food to low-income communities through its Double Up Food Bucks program, where participants can get double the SNAP and WIC benefits for fresh fruits and veggies. SFC also partners with community organizations to bring events to the market, like live music sponsored by ACL Live and 3TN ACL Live, kids yoga, and our Taste the Place sample booth. Laredo, El Centro de Laredo Farmers Market. Laredo Main Street hosts El Centro de Laredo Farmers Market, the only certified farmers market in Laredo. Held at the Veterans Memorial, Jarvis Plaza, El Centro de Laredo Farmers Market is held once a month, every third Saturday from 9 to 1. All of its vendors are located within a 200-mile radius of Laredo. Farmers unveil their seasonal produce, farm-fresh eggs, raw honey, and locally made goods, while bakers present delicious artisan breads, pastries, foods, and beverages. Entertainment varies each month with live music, yoga, spinning classes, dances, and more. The market is a family and pet-friendly event, free of charge and full of fun events for the community. El Centro de Laredo also has the luxury of offering parking at the El Metro Transit Center for free with a market purchase voucher. El Centro de Laredo also accepts merchants selling handmade arts and crafts and seeks new health-conscious vendors to participate at the market. Small farm owners, backyard gardeners, and arts and crafts hobbyists can visit www.laredomainstreet.org for more information. Brenham, First Friday's Farmer and Artisan Market. The downtown Brenham First Friday's Farmer and Artisan Market first opened in spring of 2018. What started as a little market in Brenham now hosts 30-plus regular vendors each month and is expanding to accommodate an ever-growing list of new and unique vendors. Whether you're looking for fresh meat and vegetables or a special handcrafted gift like nothing you've ever seen before, check out this market. There's something for everyone. On the first Friday of each month, except January, this market is open from 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. on the square in downtown Brenham. From the Texas Gardener, Ask Skip by Skip Richter. Question. I have some privet, holly, and ligustrum bushes that have gotten too tall to trim and are losing foliage in the lower parts of the plant. I want to prune them back to at least half their size. What time of year would be best, and how do I go about it? Answer. Early spring is a good time. Cut them back about a third past where you want the ultimate size to be to allow for some regrowth. The plants will respond with vigorous new upright growth, and you will need to cut that back partway several times to slow it down and force more branching and increase density. Your shrubs will always try to grow top-heavy, so always keep the tops narrower than the base to allow light to reach the lower areas to maintain foliage density from top to bottom. By the end of the season, you may have trimmed the shrubs back three or four more times, but will have something more to your liking. Be ready, however, for them to look pretty bleak for a good while after the initial severe pruning job. Question. How do weed and feeds work? Do they kill weeds without damaging the turf grass? Answer. Weed and feed simply means that the product contains fertilizer and some type of herbicide. The idea is that the fertilizer feeds the grass and the herbicide, while toxic to weeds will not harm the grass. If it is a pre-emergence herbicide, it will prevent weed seeds from coming up, but not control existing weeds, although some may control young weed seedlings. If it is a post-emergent herbicide, it will control existing weeds, but not prevent weed seeds from coming up. However, as usual, the devil is in the details. The best time to fertilize, especially in the spring, is usually not the optimum time to prevent weeds. The best time to start fertilizing warm season grasses in the spring is after you have mowed twice. By then, warm season weeds have long since germinated. In fall, weed prevention also comes a little prior to fertilizing. If you need to use an herbicide, it is best to first have the weeds identified so that you can choose the proper product for optimum control and also get the proper timing for application. Apply lawn fertilizer separately at the proper time. Finally, I should mention that some weed killer products can damage some turf species such as St. Augustine, especially when temperatures rise above the mid-80s. Certain pre-emergence products can inhibit turf rooting, causing a decline in the grass, especially if over-applied. The best long-term weed defense is to build a dense, healthy lawn over time by proper mowing, watering, and fertilizing. We have come to the end of our program. I have been reading The Texas Gardener. You can hear The Texas Gardener Saturday morning at 11:30 and Tuesday afternoon at 1:30. I'm Janet Roberts, and this has been a production of Sight Into Sound Radio.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Western Magazine Hour, followed by the AARP Report at 6.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Watering schedule. The City of Midland has adjusted the lawn and landscaping watering schedule, which will allow residents to water 4 days a week instead of two. Even-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and odd-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Starting Monday on the Noon Book Hour, we begin our Thanksgiving series of books with How to Bake the Perfect Pecan Pie by Gina Kalani. Lauren Hauser is home for the holidays, and she's been given a challenge, preparing her grandmother's pecan pie. The problem? Lauren's not famed for her baking skills. Still, no Thanksgiving would be complete without dessert, which is why Lauren finds herself searching for pecans on Thanksgiving Eve. Stumbling into a gorgeous stranger with bags of pecans seems like a holiday miracle. But despite Jack's kissable lips, he's frostier than a snow cone and out of sight before she can say Macy's Parade. Without her grandmother's pecan pie, it won't be a very happy Thanksgiving. What Lauren needs is a knight in shining armor, and it might just be that the magic of Thanksgiving will find her one. How to Bake the Perfect Pecan Pie by Gina Kalani, starting Monday at noon and Tuesday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 72 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 70s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the low 50s.
From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 5 p.m.